In the coming week, President Trump announces a review and funding freeze of the World Health Organization. Earth Day is commemorated across the globe, and the 40th anniversary of Cuba's Mariel boat lift to Florida is marked. It's April 16th, 2020, in time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay. Bob, it's important to note for our listeners that you and I are practicing physical distancing in recording this podcast from our respective homes. Because of that, we apologize in advance for any audio issues or if any members of our families make unscheduled guest appearances.
Well, thanks, Jim. Let's kick off with the story as it unfolds again. That would be the coronavirus. Earlier this week, President Trump decided to suspend U.S. funding of the World Health Organization. This move comes at a time when case numbers continue to soar and the president faces ongoing criticism for his response to the overall virus impact. But Jim, can you give us a sense of the context here?
Well, Bob, it's hard not to escape the conclusion that the president is looking for someone to blame. He's arguing that the United States has been ill-served by the World Health Organization because it contributes more to the WHO than China. And he's arguing that WHO has favored China since the outbreak of the pandemic. Maybe we should sort of break that claim down. First, it is undeniably true that the United States contributes substantially more to the WHO than China does. That's partly because membership assessments are based on a country's wealth and its population. And the United States is much richer than China, although China is obviously much more populous. It's partly a function of history. The United States has been the largest economy, and China was a much poorer country for a fairly long time. I should also note that the way the WHO works is that countries have the option of making voluntary contribution that is above and beyond their assessed contributions. And the United States has been more generous than China. Indeed, it's been more generous than many other countries in terms of its voluntary contributions. But on that score, that's nothing new. This has been true for a very, very long time. As for the World Health Organization's performance, I have no doubt that a postmortem will show that the agency could have done a lot of things smarter, faster, and more effectively. I mean, postmortems always show those sort of things. And it is true that the WHO leadership has said nice things about China, but that's born out of the fact that the WHO doesn't have authority over any member states. It was and always has been dependent on the willingness of countries to cooperate with it. So obviously, WHO leadership needs China's cooperation in the pandemic. But I don't think we should lose sight of the fact that the WHO has done a lot of things right. I mean, the WHO declared the epidemic a public health emergency of international concern back on January 20th. And I will note that President Trump acknowledged that at one point, tweeting in February 24th that the CDC and World Health have been working hard and very smart. So I think it's important to keep that in mind.
And it also, it's the only international universal organization dealing with global health emergencies like the current one.
It is. And again, you know, go to a bigger point, whatever the failings might be of the WHO, and all organizations have failings of some sort, they don't explain the Trump administration's shambolic response to the coronavirus. I mean, I think it's important to stress that the United States government doesn't rely on the WHO for threat assessments or health guidance or supplies. I mean, when you talk about health threat assessments, a variety of U.S. agencies do that. And as I think has been amply documented by lots of news organizations, they were warning the administration from mid-January on that the United States faced a major healthcare challenge. On a broad level, this is a bad idea on at least two levels. I mean, one is why hobble the WHO's work in the middle of a global pandemic? Even if the WHO is not essential for the U.S. fight against the coronavirus, it's important to other countries, particularly to poor countries. And I want everyone to keep in mind, viruses don't respect borders. And I think it's also going to disrupt other important healthcare efforts by the WHO, doing things like combating polio. I think also there's a real question here of the extent to which the president's announcement is actually taking pressure off of China. I mean, there has been rising anger around the world as evidence emerges that, contrary to first impressions, that Beijing tried to suppress information about the virus. And Trump's move in that way is in many ways a gift to Beijing because it puts the United States in the spotlight. I think there's a fair amount of anger in particular as African leaders see the president's move as a slap against the competence of Africans because the WHO director general happens to be Ethiopian. So I don't really see this move as serving U.S. interests in the short term. term or the long term.
No, I think you've sort of seized on it, Jim, and echoing the comment that the UN Secretary General made, Mr. Guterres, which is that there is ample need to review what happened in the outbreak of this and how this got to the extent it did, and that will be done, but now is not the time to be freezing funding on it. I think that's pretty much the resounding response around the world, including from countries that have been critical of some of the WHO's actions, you know, vis-a-vis China.
And again, Bob, I mean, you think on this issue, like in a lot of issues with President Trump, the president's own words have been inconsistent. I mean, again, the president in the past has praised WHO. Likewise, the president has both been critical of China and full of praise for Chinese leader Xi Jinping. And so I think many of those sort of confused messages, I think, undermine U.S. policy interests.
The trend lines for how this virus and this global crisis is going to be dealt with involves global cooperation and, you know, working across boundaries. As you said, the virus does not respect boundaries, and there needs to be consistent action coming from the U.S., which in the past has been in a leadership role in such things.
You're right to highlight the importance of global cooperation, Bob, and sadly, I don't think we're getting the level of cooperation that we need to combat the pandemic. But let's change gears, Bob, and talk about an anniversary. This coming Wednesday, April the 22nd, will mark the 50th anniversary of Earth Day. I actually can remember the first Earth Day, so I guess that means I'm officially old. The anniversary commemorates the birth of the 1970 modern environmental movement. Of course, Earth Day this year will be celebrated differently than in years past. So tell us a bit more, Bob, about Earth Day 2020.
Well, Earth Day 2020 will be a digital Earth Day for understandable reasons, given the physical distancing that is still being stressed really worldwide. You're not going to be seeing rallies of people clustered together in city streets or in fields or anywhere, really. You're also not going to be seeing people jetting around the world to join various events, which I think will make some environmentalists happy because they point to the incongruity of the burning of jet fuel and the celebration of the Earth's vulnerable environment and so forth. But it really is going to be a day marked with people sort of sitting in front of screens and engaging across the world through things like webinars and live streamed events and various sharing of documentaries created to celebrate the world and its vulnerability and then the need to do something about it. There's going to be a great deal of stress on trying to note the present moment, not only as a moment of vulnerability for public health, but also what it means for the way environmental action needs to be galvanized as well. It's worth noting, back to your original intro on this, Jim, that the original Earth Day came, it was the brainchild of a U.S. senator from Wisconsin, Gaylord Nelson. It came after a decade or a period of time, really, where the trends environmentally were pretty awful. And it had certainly had a touchy-feely aspect to it, but it also did galvanize action, including in the U.S., including under Republican administration. I mean, you had the administration of Richard Nixon, among other things, creating the Environmental Protection Agency. You had Clean Air Act, clean water legislation passed. A number of real tangible developments happened, and a sense of sort of some shared responsibility about and sort of a shared benchmarks about what should be done to protect air, water, and the globe. We're now in a period now where, you know, there's this fracturing, especially in the U.S., over sort of seen as environmental issue number one, climate change. And while you have this pause in carbon emissions levels really worldwide, there's a great expectation that it's only going to come bouncing back, especially as there's pressure for the world to ramp up economically and what that usually brings in terms of energy usage and so forth. So it's an important moment to mark this big anniversary. It would have been anyway, but during a pandemic like this, I think it feeds extra food for thought. And I think people are going to have a lot more time than they might have had in the past to sort of take on these messages. We'll see if they stick, but it seems to be taking place in an especially meaningful time, I would say.
You know, Bob, it is remarkable the way Earth Day galvanized attention back in the early 1970s about environmental issues. And obviously, it grew out of concern that we were essentially poisoning ourselves. One of the big books of the 1960s was Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, the problems caused by the use of DDT and other pesticides, but you also had the use of leaded gas. And I think for a lot of Americans who were born well after the 1970s, don't really have an appreciation for how dirty our environment was and how much progress we were able to make by virtue of smart government policy to address things like lead in the air, pesticides, and the rest. Indeed, how foul many lakes and streams were and how much progress we've made.
On the famous river in Cleveland that caught fire.
Yes. And I think it's, you know, this is a reminder to us that government is able to solve problems. I think right now we're in a situation which we often think of government as incapable of doing things. But we had smart policy that actually improved things tangibly, I mean, in a measurable way. And what's remarkable about it is, I think, a point you made, which was in the early 1970s, the efforts for clean air, clean water, and the rest were bipartisan. And you're right, it was Richard Nixon who helped champion the creation operation of the Environmental Protection Agency. But today, when we deal with climate change, we've sort of divided up into two camps, and they align with the parties, one that wants to take the issue seriously, the other one that dismisses it as inconsequential. And the fact is, I think we actually have a real ability to make a dent in the emission of heat-trapping gases, and we can do it in ways that can actually promote economic growth. But sadly, we're not, which is going to make the problem worse, and the bill, when it comes, much, much higher.
Yeah, and it's been pointed out that the climate changes, although they have been quite evident and increasingly so in the form of extreme weather, or point to whatever your issue is, the shocking sort of decline in honeybee populations, whatever. But it's still much more of a slow motion type of threat than a pandemic can be. And yet the results are pretty devastating. So as I say, Jim, it's going to be interesting to see to what extent the adherence to, you know, scientific norms in this health crisis in any way translate into a respect for what is seen as scientific consensus about climate impacts caused by carbon emissions and whether or not it changes or not. You know, there's been all sorts of, I mentioned the emissions issue. On the other side of that, one of the changes that's happened as this health crisis has mushroomed is increasing generation of trash and use of plastic and, yep, and sort of an abandonment of some of the things that had been adopted even outside of federal government control, like the winnowing use of plastics and things. So again, it's a real gut check for not only the United States really, but for the world.
Bob, let's talk about another notable anniversary that's going to be marked next week, and that is the 40th anniversary of the Mariel boat lift from Cuba to Florida. On April 20th, 1980, Fidel Castro announced that all Cubans who wanted to emigrate to the United States could board boats at the port of Mariel, which is just west of Havana. And following that, the first of an estimated 125,000 Cubans left Cuba for Florida. Can you talk a little bit more about the significance of the Mariel boat lift, Bob?
Yeah, so whereas I had a little bit of memory of the first Earth Day, I had a lot stronger memory of this. This was a huge event, a rolling event, really. It was a six-month period where, as you mentioned, 125,000 in total Cuban refugees left Cuba, the port of Mariel, about a 90-minute rough passage to Florida. And almost all of them did, I think, end up in Florida eventually. I remember at the time, among the controversies, it was a great strain on the U.S. And the U.S. was, you know, obviously superpower at this time period, had introduced some easing of relations under the Carter administration with Cuba. But this was seen as sort of a release valve for Cuban dissent, shall we say. There had been a lot of protests building up to this moment. And Castro finally said, hey, you know what? You want to leave? Go ahead and leave. What he also did, though, was he did things like empty out prisons and some mental hospitals. And so you had a mixture of people who were protesting Cuban tyranny, but also people who were just common criminals. Some of them were separated and detained in the U.S. I should say the vast majority of these were not criminals and were not sort of deranged people, but were Cubans who were seeking freedom, who had made a very difficult passage to the United States. And because of U.S. laws, had a pathway to citizenship and really sort of transformed Southern Florida in the process. They've now been more than a generation in Florida, this population of Cuban exiles. And it was a huge event. It was an event that seemed to point to the stark differences between repressive Cuba and open United States. And it's the kind of thing I don't think you'd see in this day and age, it's safe to say, given not only the virus concerns, but what has been U.S. policy leading up to that.
Oh, it certainly was remarkable, Bob, at the time to see the influx. On the one hand, people were very excited that people were getting to leave Cuba. Obviously, Cuba has been a focus of U.S. foreign policy for a long time. But there was also the concern about how do you actually absorb that many people that quickly? You point to the fact that a small portion, when I emphasize a small portion, were criminals or people who had mental health issues and the like. And that was, in some sense, the Castro government's way of sort of offloading the problem. But for the most part, you had people who wanted to escape tyranny and wanted to go to a place where they could have freedom and economic success. I mean, I've had the great pleasure in my life to have met people who came over as part of the Mariel boat lift and subsequently, and to a person, they're remarkably grateful for the opportunity that the United States afforded them. And when you hear some of the tales of what life was like under the Castro regime, you're reminded about what a wretched government Cuba had, and I think to this day still has, notwithstanding its great success in providing health care and the rest, but it was and remains a deeply authoritarian state, which greatly limits the freedom and rights of individuals.
Yeah, mean, it's now been labeled as part of, under the Trump administration's labeling, of the Troika of Tyranny, along with Venezuela and Nicaragua, in this hemisphere at least. And there had been another period of easing of relations with Cuba under the Obama administration. Trump administration officials came in and quickly asserted that that easing seemed to translate into very little by way of easing on Cuban human rights practices and so forth. There's some debate over that, over what the criteria are and whether or not Cuba could still be nudged in that direction. But at this point, we're looking at a very frosty relationship. But also, it is hard to imagine a Cuban leader today in the post-Castro era or anywhere really, a leader just sort of telling its people, go ahead, you don't like it here, leave, you know, and sort of allowing such a thing to take place. It is extraordinary to reflect on that.
And certainly for the United States, it came at a time of, I think, real sort of self-doubt on part of many Americans about their place in the world. Again, you're talking 1980. This is about 5 years after the end of the Vietnam War. You have the Iran hostage crisis on. The economy was doing incredibly poorly. And I think for some people, there was a real sense that the United States no longer had control. And I sort of think about it, cause to some extent today, we feel like we're losing control. But you look at it, what was the sort of trajectory of American history after 1980 actually was quite positive. I guess I'm optimistic that as challenging as our current situation is today, we're also going to look back on it a few years down the road from a better place.
Well, Jim, we've made it to the figure of the week portion of our podcast this week. And so I'm going to start off with you. Who or what is your figure of the week?
Bob, my figure of the week is a number. It's the number 10, as in 10 yards. That is how close naval vessels operated by Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps came to six U.S. Navy ships and a Coast Guard cutter operating in the Persian Gulf in international waters.
10 yards. Wow.
10 yards, 30 feet, 9 meters. That's pretty close. And it came a day after an Iranian group briefly commandeered a tanker that came into the Persian Gulf. I flag it simply to remind everybody, as we're focused right now on the pandemic and its impact and global cooperation, that traditional issues in world politics, security issues, still continue to bubble along. There is this issue of tensions between the United States and Iran. The Iranians are acting in provocative ways. It's not too hard to imagine when you have these efforts to harass that somebody misjudged and all of a sudden your 10 yards becomes no yards and you have an accident and the potential for things to escalate. And the Persian Gulf remains a very challenging place. And the tensions between the United States and Iran remain high. With any good luck, these incidents stop. We don't see any escalation and we can concentrate on other issues. But again, there is a potential for this conflict to go from 0 to 60, so to speak, very, very quickly.
Some people note that during various crises, they are sometimes pose opportunities to break through impasses and so forth. It's safe to say that's not been the case with the U.S.-Iran tensions. Whether you talk about the provision of health supplies or allowing health supplies into the country or anything else that these two countries are dealing with, it's only seemed to have gotten worse regarding issues like the one you just mentioned or proxy battles and or whatever.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think clearly the Trump administration had said, we believe in our maximum pressure strategy. We're going to stick with it and we're going to force the mullahs to cry uncle. And we simply wait for that to happen. Now, what we've seen thus far is that the Iranian leadership has responded to that pressure, not by backing off or offering concessions, but upping the ante. Now, they've been very cautious in a sense of acting through proxies, engaging in provocations that are on the margins. They haven't, at least in the last several months, moved anything to quite the extent we had last year with the attack on the Saudi oil facilities. So these, again, these provocations may remain in check. But the challenge you always have in these situations is that actions you take that you think you can control can get out of control. And then what happens when you get on a ladder of escalation? And I think that's really sort of the challenge here for the U.S. government, for the U.S. military, for the Trump administration, to both be firm, but potentially to avoid a situation where tensions ratchet pretty quickly. And again, they can ratchet very, very quickly. What about you, Bob? Who or what is your figure of the week?
Jim, my figure is a person, and it is South Korean President Moon Jae-in. He is presiding over quite an electoral victory wave in this week's South Korean elections. His Democratic Party, together with a small satellite party, won something like 180 seats in the National Assembly, which is 300 seats. That is the biggest majority any party has won since the country's transition to democracy back in 1987, according to the results announced. And the turnout was in the middle middle of still battling a pandemic. Turnout was 66%, the highest in general elections since 1992. So I think it's safe to say government performance translated into electoral success in South Korea.
Oh, it certainly did. And actually, that was going to be my other figure of the week. So I'm glad you raised it, because I would have said late last year that President Moon and President Moon's party was in trouble domestically in South Korea. He had been criticized for his inability to deliver in a variety of pledges that he had campaigned on, not just on his hopes to sort of open up and reset the relation with North Korea, but again, coming into 2020 with the rise of the pandemic, the Moon administration, I think, really displayed a seriousness, a recognition of what needed to be done very early on. And I'm told that part of the reason we've seen the kind of very quick reaction by the South Korean government is because several years ago, a South Korean businessman came back from the Middle East, bringing back MERS, the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, and managed to affect a number of people. And so there was an outbreak that threatened to become quite large. I think South Korea was the hardest hit country outside of the Middle East. And the government learned a fair amount from that incident. And that really sort of gave them sort of training in how to respond to the coronavirus this time around. And they clearly learned their lessons well.
Yeah, they had a playbook and they went with it. And one of the aspects of it, from what I've seen in the reports, is that the president basically got out of the way. And as part of the guidance to respond to this, is let the health professionals in the government take over and communicate the guidelines, message them. I don't think the government ever imposed a lockdown to date in South Korea. And yet the other steps that they took, including vigorous testing and I think what they call contact tracing, have been seen as a kind of a model for the rest of the world to examine. And the rest of the world is looking at it very closely, because I think you're seeing in the West is an absolute eagerness to get back to some sort of normalcy. And as the economic figures get worse and worse, some ability to get a handle and a knowledge about the spread of this thing. And South Korea has emerged as a model.
Yeah. Admittedly, for the South Koreans, this has been a big challenge. It required a mobilization of a lot of resources. But again, they have been quite effective in curtailing the virus. And just to give you one statistic to compare where South Korea is versus the United States. The United States now has an estimated 86 deaths per million people. In the case of South Korea, that number is 4 per million people. So South Korea clearly is one of the countries that stands out as a success story in this, even though it was one of the first countries to feel the impact of the coronavirus. So again, another example of how governments can be effective when faced with very large challenges.
Well, on that hopeful note, that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. The annual Global Solutions Summit will be held virtually, and a meteor shower hits its peak next week. It's called the Lyrid Meteor Shower.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Our recording engineer this week was Zoe Collis, who once again pulled double duty. Thank you, Zoe. I also want to give special thanks to Anu Kumar, Claire McGraw, and Anna Shortridge for their assistance. Our theme music was provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and be safe out there.